the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hello there, how are you all? Welcome to another episode of the What Bitcoin Did podcast, which is brought to you by the mighty Kraken, the best place to buy, sell, and trade Bitcoin. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and today I've got part 9 of my Beginner's Guide to Bitcoin, a fascinating interview with Nick Carter, looking at the history of altcoins and their high failure rate. But before that, I do have a message from my show sponsors. So first up, today's show is brought to you by the amazing BlockFi, the future of Bitcoin and financial services. And BlockFi kicked off 2020 with a massive announcement. They will be launching a BTC rewards card where you can earn sats back rewards. I can't wait to get mine. I've been pushing Zach. I've been saying, come on, man, when do I get mine? As soon as I get it, I'll be showing you. I'll be demoing it. I will be earning sats back with my card. They have also got a mobile app coming soon, which is very exciting. And this is on top of their already market-leading crypto-backed loans and their interest accounts. And it's the end of the month. I'm a customer. I will be checking out my balance in the next couple of days, looking at my interest. I've been with them now, I think it's about 6 months, 6 or 7 months, getting my interest on my Bitcoin. I love it. If you are interested in finding out more about this, head over to blockfi.com, which is BLOCKFI.com. Next up, today's show is brought to you by the mighty Kraken, the best place to buy, sell, and trade Bitcoin. You know Kraken now, but are you using them? Are you a Kraken customer like me? If not, why? They are the most secure exchange out there. You might have heard about various exchange hacks at times. Well, Kraken put the safeguarding of your funds and your privacy as their number one objective. And they also have the best suite of tools available for you traders out there. They've got Kraken.com, which is the best place to trade Bitcoin. You also get access to up-to-the-second pricing data with their cryptocurrency indices, which is powered by CF benchmarks. You've got next-level trading with Bitcoin futures. They've got their amazing OTC desk with deeper liquidity and private and more personalized services. They've also got CryptoWatch, where you can access markets across multiple exchanges at a glance. And they also have Kraken Pro, a beautiful mobile-first app, so you can trade Kraken on the go wherever you want. There is no better place to trade Bitcoin. So find out more at Kraken.com, which is Kraken.com. And the app is available for the iPhone and Android. Just search for Kraken Pro, which is Kraken Pro. Okay, so on to the show today, part 9 of my Beginner's Guide to Bitcoin. And I've got Nick Carter on. He's been on the show a couple of times before, and he was on to discuss the history of altcoins. Now, anyone new coming into Bitcoin may be seduced by the world of crypto and altcoins. I certainly was, made a bunch of mistakes. And I just want people to realize that this can come with significant financial risk. So it's an important subject to cover in the Bitcoin Beginner's Guide, not only because it can save from financial pain, but also by understanding the failure of altcoins, it helps you understand a bit more about why Bitcoin is king and why it's been designed in the way it is. It is very easy to fall for the marketing around shitcoins, whether it's quicker or cheaper transactions, smart contracts, anonymity, different consensus mechanisms, or anything else. And without a ton of experience, how would you be expected to navigate this? Well, price action certainly helps, and the trend with altcoin valuations is hard evidence for you about this failure rate. So what I want to make it clear in this show is that when you hear some altcoin promoted, some technical benefit it has over Bitcoin, it usually comes at a trade-off that's not worth it. Do not think that the core devs have not thought about these ideas and looked at the trade-offs and realized it's not worth it. So Nick was perfect for this show, and he is somewhat of an altcoin historian. And in this show, he runs through the history of the alts. We pick out the main projects and, you know, what they were trying to do. We also look at the ICO bubble of 1718, and then we get into why all alts are probably doomed for failure. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the show. If you've got any questions about it, you can reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Nick, hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on again.
No worries. Always a pleasure to have you on. So I'm doing this Bitcoin Beginner's Guide series. It's going to be about 15 episodes just to have a repository of, you know, interviews that if somebody wants to get into Bitcoin, I can send them to, other people can send them to. And I've done a, you know, why we need Bitcoin, the history of Bitcoin, what Bitcoin is, the technical level. But in planning, I wanted to do a show about the history of altcoins because I think it's very easy for somebody discovering Bitcoin or even an altcoin first, but discovering Bitcoin then to suddenly be tempted with this world of cryptocurrencies and altcoins. And I've seen far too many people, myself included, lose money going down this rabbit hole. So I thought if we can do the history of altcoins, we can essentially go through what is really, as we discuss, a history of failure. Are you cool with this?
Yeah, that's right. The history of altcoins is a history of failure. Yeah.
So we're going to cover a couple of things. I think we'll cover the types of altcoins, why they exist, and then we'll kind of chronologically go through some of the projects. I know you're a bit of a historian. So you're going to enjoy this.
I'm an amateur altcoin historian. That's right. I find it so interesting, you know, to see these things come and go. And I also think have an appreciation for the history of alts, you know, is important because people are sometimes naive, you know, like they look at aggregate measures like the total capitalization of altcoins, you know, and they assume that the ancient alt that they're holding is like going to pump again, you know. But in fact, there's like a huge amount of churn within that set, you know. And so as it, you know, I think in reality, most altcoins generally, this is what we've seen so far, they just kind of fade away to nothingness over time. And then it's typically like newer alts or ICOs, which are like part of that new cohort of like sexy new projects, which end up pumping the next time.
We often hear the overuse of the word scam. Some people say, oh, everything's a scam. And I've always felt that's unuseful. I always wanted to grade certain projects to say, look, there are definite scams, projects which are invented just to rip people off. Then I think there's also misguided projects where people think they can use blockchain to build something of value. But that kind of goes into that history of failure that we've talked about. But just to call everything a scam, I think it doesn't really help.
Yeah, it's not very, yeah, I agree. It's not the most helpful, you know, nomenclature. You know, I sometimes call these subset of these things like deliberately extractive projects, you know, so you can definitely do a gradation there where you find projects which seem like they're intended to extract value as opposed to like create value. And then some projects which are just extremely naive.
And you know what? You can still make money on these altcoins. That's not to say that as well. And there are people out there who are, you know, multi-coiners who are fully believing in altcoins and will trade them all day. And there are people who are Bitcoin maximalists who think these things have no value but are still happy to trade them to make Bitcoin. But the reality is trading these coins and timing them is very hard. And, you know, for me, if somebody's new's coming in, I really don't want them to risk losing their Bitcoin by trading what is essentially junk.
Yeah, absolutely not recommended. I certainly don't trade alts and haven't for a long time. And, you know, we're going to cover a lot of coins and projects today, and I want to very much stress that I am not endorsing any of them. But I also don't want to be too harsh. I want to basically give them a fair shake.
Yeah, and also, in fairness, some of these projects have led to innovations which have been used in Bitcoin. Some of them, it's almost like we needed to go through this. Certainly a few times, maybe not thousands of times, but clearly need to go through this a few times to learn what the power of the blockchain is for Bitcoin and where the value is in Bitcoin. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah. And also, there's a lot of lessons learned from some of these experiments. You know, some things that Bitcoiners would caution against, like an unlimited block size, for instance, or, you know, exotic proof-of-work hash functions, these were then instrumentalized in other projects, and we saw lots of failures. So empirically, we learned a lot from, you know, the way some of these altcoins operated. So there was experimental value there too.
Right. Okay, cool. So before we get into this, I did take a look on CoinMarketCap. There was 2,388 coins listed, and that doesn't include all tokens. You know, we know on some of the exchanges, there's endless tokens. So we're talking about thousands of projects. And between you and I, we have a long-term belief in one, which is Bitcoin. And I guess between you and I, we imagine there may be two or three that will continue to hold a community, maybe for a few years. We don't know how long. But generally speaking, I think we're on agreement that if we had to put our, you know, we had to put our fork in the sand and say in 10 years' time, the one that will still be there and probably will be worth more than it is now is Bitcoin. Is that a fair agreement?
Yeah, totally. But I'd also say that I've probably been watching these markets for about 7 years, and I've learned never to bet against like the ingenuity of token issuers. You know, so there's always going to be something out there. And I would also some of the Bitcoiners might not like me for saying this, but I would say Ethereum seems to have critical mass. You know, it seems to have enough momentum to stick around.
All right, so listen, before we jump into the types of coins, you know, and how they're created and the different types of consensus mechanisms, you rightly said when I was planning this, we should probably look a little bit at the prehistory. And I've already covered this with Aaron Van Weerden. We did the prehistory of Bitcoin. You know, we covered some of these projects, but I think the prehistory and post-history is very interesting because at the genesis of Bitcoin, finally something that was created that solved a number of issues that those trying to create a decentralized or a digital currency beforehand had tried to, hadn't managed to do. So before we cover the prehistory and the post-history, do you want to talk about what it is that Bitcoin solved that almost enabled all these other projects to exist after?
Totally. So Satoshi made reference to this as well. So what he said was, he talked about some of these digital cash schemes like Liberty Reserve and eGold, which had existed prior to Bitcoin. And he said it was the centrally controlled nature of these projects that doomed them. So all of these digital cash schemes, DigiCash, Liberty Reserve, eGold, and many others, they all basically had a central issuer, kind of a bank or a coordinator managing the whole process. What Bitcoin was able to do was take the peer-to-peer innovations, which we saw with something like BitTorrent, and layer on this costly ledger entry idea, which came from ideas like Hashcash, which was kind of designed to prevent email spam, put all those things together and create a decentralized issuer where you had miners working together to issue the coins and to order the transactions so that Bitcoin could solve this double spend problem. So it was a combination of many innovations which enabled Bitcoin to not rely on a single trusted third party. That was really the innovation.
Right, okay. So listen, we covered DigiCash in that previous show, and I'll encourage people, if they haven't listened to it, to go backwards and do the whole beginner's guide sequentially, and it is useful. But do you want to briefly touch on DigiCash, who it is, what it achieved, and why it failed?
Yeah, I like DigiCash. David Chaum is a cryptographer, and he invented these cryptographic signatures called blind signatures in the 80s, and then he started a company called DigiCash in 1990. So what it basically allowed was users to load money into essentially a bank of sorts, which issued these digital bills. And so what his innovation was, that users of that bank basically had privacy. So they could, thanks to this digital signature scheme, they could provably know that they had anonymity from a transactional perspective. And I think this is one of the most influential kind of pre-Bitcoin experiments because, it was reliant on this corporation, on the fate of the corporation, which failed in the 90s. So I think a lot of the cypherpunks learned from that. Some of the cypherpunks actually worked at DigiCash. So Zuko of Zcash fame, he worked there. And, it was weird. Like DigiCash could have been really interesting. So like Bill Gates wanted to put a version of the DigiCash software into every copy of Windows 95. So it was really on the cusp of greatness. But I think ultimately it was just relying on the existence of this company. And, unlike Bitcoin, it was a product as opposed to just a protocol. So there were, it was still this like issue with the central issuer, basically.
Yeah, and also I think David Chaum deserves a lot of respect. He very early on identified issues with privacy relating to the internet, and he did a lot of very important work with cryptography. So even if that was a failure, I think the memory of what he does, we need to embed that in any work. There's a lot of people we could forget about in the history of Bitcoin, but his work is so important.
Yeah, absolutely foundational, and you're absolutely right. Even before the internet really existed in a consumer fashion, we're talking about the 80s here, he was adamant that the advent of digital cash could create a panopticon for regulators, for the state, for corporations, and he was absolutely right. Look at central bank digital currencies. Today, that's a desire to create a system where every transaction is logged and known. And David Chaum rebelled against this incredibly hard. And he was like, no, we need to create an alternative with strong privacy. And many would say that's like the biggest shortcoming of Bitcoin, that there isn't the strong privacy.
All right. Now tell me a bit more about eGold, because that isn't a project I know too much about.
Okay. So eGold was also mentioned a lot by the cypherpunks. Part of the reason is because it failed just as Bitcoin was being set up. So the two kind of intersected in 2009. eGold was failing. Bitcoin was getting started. So eGold was created by an oncologist, a surgeon, basically. But he was also obsessed with monetary history, and he became absolutely obsessed with this idea of curating currency outside of the control of governments. Sound familiar? But, Bitcoin didn't exist back when he created it in 1996. So he decided to create basically a full reserve bank backed by gold deposits, you know, actual gold. And the innovation was to make transactions digital. So, you know, unlike, you know, old timey banks where you would get, you know, physical bills, here you would get, you know, a digital claim on some bank reserves, you know, IOUs that you could, you know, spend. And like people think that, you know, stable coins are kind of a relatively new phenomenon, but this was basically the first or one of the first digital stable coins, you know, and it actually got a ton of usage. So at its peak, it probably had about $80 million of gold, physical gold in the vaults. It was doing $2 billion a year. They actually kept fairly good data. They had audits from an audit firm, but then eventually they were shut down because the Patriot Act was passed after 9/11, and the Bank Secrecy Act regulations came to encompass more and more different classes of activity, including e-gold. And so the founder actually went to jail for a little bit after that. So kind of a tragic story as well.
Right. Okay. So the next two things are two projects I'd never heard of. I'd literally never heard of beans or flues, but they're two things you raised and you appear to be fascinated by them.
So I wanted to cover these because, so if you look at DigiCash and eGold, these are like really serious projects with a really serious objective, you know, DigiCash, transactional privacy, eGold to create a digital, essentially monetary system, a fully independent digital monetary system. Beans and Flues, by contrast, are two of the worst projects ever conceived, and I absolutely hate them. So, but they're interesting because they're the precursor to ICOs. So if anything, they were the first ICOs. So Beans raised $100 million from VCs in 1998 at the absolute peak of the dot-com bubble. Their idea was to create an internet currency for, you know, internet merchants, which were just getting started around the time. And they wasted this $100 million. They spent it on the stupidest stuff imaginable, like guerrilla marketing. So they actually paid magicians to like slip flyers secretly into the pockets of the general public. It was a free floating coin, so it wasn't pegged to some reserve. And as it turns out, you know, Amazon and, you know, other e-commerce startups, they didn't want a volatile, free floating internet currency. They wanted to use credit cards for their payment processing. So Beans and Flues, which was also very similar, both failed. And they had like celebrity endorsements, you know, like it was a whole mess that we saw like 20 years later with ICOs.
Yeah, I was just saying there's so many similarities between these projects in 98, 99 and all the kind of crazy ICOs of, you know, let's say 2017, 2018, where a huge amount of money was raised, wasted on the most ridiculous things. I'll add into celebrity endorsements. You know, you had people raising money who were getting private jets and flying around the world and really enjoying themselves without creating any value. So there's a real similarity between the two. And I think that just kind of identifies a little bit about how the human psyche works.
Yeah, totally. Everything is old. Everything old is new again, you know? And like these were intended as utility coins. So it's amazing because like the founders of both Beans and Flues, which had this horrible like 90s aesthetic to them, they didn't give any thought to like the economy of these projects at all. They just kind of figured that if there was enough transactional usage, the coin would have value. Does that sound familiar? You know?
Yep.
So they were utility tokens. And they also did this amazing thing. Like when they started to fail, they like hired economists to see if they could like figure out how to like figure out the token economics, you know, which is something we've seen with projects today. So I love these case studies because these were so, so similar to a lot of these subsequent VC-backed, you know, ICOs.
But it also shows that there is a desire amongst humans to be able to create money.
100%. It's the biggest prize imaginable. And the only difference between these early attempts to create money and now is that Bitcoin was created in 2009, and it made everyone realize subsequent to that that they could actually do it. You know, I like to say the Overton window was opened, so it became permissible to really try your hand at creating a money. And also Bitcoin created a financial system that made it easy to send money to issuers. So it made it, you know, less frictional from kind of a capital markets perspective to create these new coins.
And one of the important differences with Bitcoin, and we can really only say, you know, up until the present day, but it appears whoever that creator is hasn't done it so far to enrich themselves. Now, that's going to be something very hard to prove false. It's always going to be something in the future that we never know if Satoshi will reappear, move the coins and sell them. But, you know, if that person is choosing just to wait for a certain time in the future, they have some nerves of steel because they've held their coins up through multiple bull runs and, you know, some crazy numbers. But it appears that at the present, this hasn't been somebody attempting to create money to enrich themselves.
Totally. And, Satoshi also chose anonymity, and so they were never able to publicly take credit for their invention. So whoever they are, they've shown some extreme restraint in staying anonymous all these years. And that is something that really distinguishes Bitcoin from virtually everything else.
Okay, so the one more project pre-Bitcoin we should talk about is Liberty Reserve. Its history kind of is pre-Bitcoin, but kind of carries through. But again, this is a really interesting project because actually what happened to the founders and the kind of the stretch of the government when they feel their money's being, you know, threatened, let's say.
Totally, totally. So Liberty Reserve was what we would know today as a stable coin. You know, they were started in 2006, incorporated in Costa Rica, I believe, and shut down in 2013. So you would wire in funds and through this kind of shadow bank network, and you would get access to these Liberty Reserve tokens, which you could send to anyone online with no KYC whatsoever. So you can see in kind of the light of day today why the government would have, not liked this idea. So they did a ton of volume. They did like 55 million transactions, billions of dollars transactional volume. So it was kind of viewed as a jurisdiction independent PayPal. So obviously, money launderers and scam artists got a hold of it. Normal people also used it. And, when the whole system collapsed, a lot of normal folks lost their money just because this notion of a financial rails online has a lot of appeal for a lot of people, not just, people that are trying to launder money. And then when it was shut down, the founder got 20 years in prison. So the stakes were really high. The government cracked down extremely hard. And that was another lesson in kind of centralized money creation. So, this was like definitely a reason Bitcoiners or Satoshi was so paranoid, and another reason why a decentralized model makes sense.
So before we get into the world of the project since Bitcoin, people coming in are going to hear this term shitcoin. And when I first started hearing the term shitcoin, I didn't realize that most people are using it to reference anything that isn't Bitcoin. Like anything that's not Bitcoin is a shitcoin. We should probably explain where the history of that comes from.
Sure, yeah. So shitcoin, not a word I use a lot, but very popular among Bitcoiners. So I traced back the first mention. It looks like it was first used on Bitcoin Talk forums in 2010 by a user, Rybuck. So the quote is, "If Bitcoin really takes off, I can see lots of get-rich-quick imitators coming onto the scene. Gitcoin, which actually is a coin now,
yeah.
Bitcoin, Witcoin, Titcoin, Shitcoin. Some of them are sure to attract users with promises," and he goes on and on. And then he says, "Of course, the cheap imitators will disappear as quickly as those 90s quote-unquote internet currencies like flus and beans, but lots of people will get burned along the way."
When was that quote? Like, what's the date of that quote?
In November 2010.
That's pretty prophetic.
Amazingly prescient, yeah. And then Gavin Anderson, Bitcoin's maintainer at the time, actually comments in that thread. He says, "The hard part would be getting anybody to use your alternative. It would have to be better in some way other than just I started the new chain," which is so funny to look at this stuff, 10 years on.
Well, so it's very interesting. I did a show with Jimmy Song a couple of months back called Killing the Hopes and Dreams of Shitcoin Backholders. And he did a lot of research into this, and he said the main reasons that shitcoins have attracted money, and maintained a community is all down to marketing. They market some benefit. It's faster, it's cheaper. So we often see people getting into, rants online on Twitter about XRP or Nano or Bcash, and it's usually some kind of different benefit where they talk about, Bitcoin is old technology, it's archaic and slow, blah, blah, blah. And they spout something about, some technical improvement that the coin they're interested in has had. But really what they seem to miss is that it's never really down to the technical limitations of Bitcoin.
Yeah, totally. And to be sure, Bitcoin has some limitations. You know, you could say, well, the opcodes aren't sufficiently expressive. You can't do enough with it. And there is a narrow, very small category of coins that, you know, can be more expressive and do more things. However, that often comes at a significant trade-off. Then some of these claims that are used to promote altcoins are simply false. You know, so Litecoin was always marketed as being just straightforwardly faster than Bitcoin. You know, you'll see that, or having ASIC resistance. So it's faster in a kind of a very naive sense and not a realistic sense. And I don't know if we have time to get into that. But in terms of being ASIC resistant, that was disproved. Someone made ASICs for Litecoin, you know. So oftentimes the claims are either incredibly naive and are later proven to be false, or, you know, there's trade-offs that basically aren't being mentioned. But yeah, this is kind of the premise of altcoins. There's always some slight innovation or claimed innovation against Bitcoin, which they use to tout their project.
But I could argue, and I have argued in the past, that sometimes these claims help improve the immune system of Bitcoin. They help prove some of the design decisions were correct.
Yeah, totally. So, for instance, many times when additional complexity is added, this often manifests later in some sort of unforeseen catastrophic failure of a sort. So one example would be this coin called Verge, which had 5 hash functions, which was claimed to be more secure than Bitcoin, which just has the one, SHA-256. And this 5 hash function system just added a lot of complexity and added attack surface. And Verge was attacked, and there was kind of a hyperinflation event on Verge. So that's one example. Another one would be some of these privacy-enhancing schemes. Now, you know, I'm not against privacy, but we also have to be really careful in the way that we add it to Bitcoin. So Bitcoin was a privacy coin with confidential transactions. Bitcoin had an inflation bug, and it couldn't be directly perceived because of this privacy scheme where you couldn't see the amounts and transactions. So if that happened on Bitcoin, it would be catastrophic, right? So, you know, as I said, altcoins are an opportunity to learn about why Bitcoin makes certain trade-offs as opposed to others.
Well, so we can work through the categories. So I've listed the categories of coins that exist, and we can work through them and also kind of discuss where we think there's been any benefit, you know, anything we've learned from them that help improve Bitcoin or prove themselves to be kind of like a wasted project. So, yeah, you know, I leave Bitcoin out as its own category of coin. But then we have Bitcoin-like money coins, which is Bcash, Litecoin, Dogecoin. And for me personally, they proved a couple of things. They proved to me, firstly, that having a leader is actually a bad thing. Having somebody out there as leading the project, as a figurehead, you know, we have Roger Ver with Bcash, we have Charlie Lee with Litecoin, you know, that proves actually to be a fault, and that actually proves to be a problem with the coin, because people, they kind of look towards their leader to make decisions or to, you know, drive investment. I mean, we've seen it only this week with Bcash now having a tax for development. So that proved that for me, but also it proved to me that what's important with, you know, a money coin like Bitcoin is that actually it isn't always about the tech. It actually is about the trust in the system, the developers, and actually one of the things about Bitcoin that's most important is its immaculate conception, which Dan Held talks about.
Yeah, totally. So the leadership, you know, having nice marketing and having leaders and central coordination around the narrative and the messaging, it seems like an asset, but really most of the time it's a liability, for sure. So in the short term, it can work, you know, because they can drum up support, like sign partnerships, you know, with other projects or companies. But in the case of, for instance, Litecoin, Charlie Lee infamously, you know, sold all his Litecoins or claimed to sell all his Litecoins near the top, and Litecoiners kind of hate him for it now. In Bitcoin Cash, they had these charismatic leaders. You know, some of them went and actually split the chain and created a fork, which fragmented the community. And then now we have Roger Ver creating or trying to create a developer fund, which is basically siphoning protocol rewards off for some kind of totally unspecified purpose. So generally speaking, having leaders creates a point of failure. You know, governments of the world could put pressure on these people, and I'm sure they will if these coins were to get traction. And a big liability, a kind of a long-term liability. And you're also indexing the fate of your coin to, you know, the kind of mercurial attitudes of some, you know, internet charismatic coin salesman, you know? So kind of a bad idea overall. I'm pretty glad Satoshi, you know, stayed silent all these years.
Yeah. So next we have the privacy monetary coins. Again, Bitcoin-like, but they offer on-chain privacy, such as Monero and Zcash. And again, you know, privacy is something that's really important with Bitcoin. But if it's on-chain, it comes with a trade-off. And I think that's one of the things we've learned about, that perhaps the trade-off isn't worth it. And usually this refers to knowing that the 21 million exists and there's no inflation.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, I would consider the privacy coin segment to be a super valid alternative design space, right? So, like, Monero has no pre-mine, and it seems to render a pretty useful service to people that really need it. You know, however, there are really difficult design considerations that need to be reckoned with. So it kind of depends on the privacy scheme you're using. But for instance, the way Monero works is it's difficult to prune output, so it's less scalable. And transactions are much larger because it's a different kind of cryptography. And then, of course, you have these issues with potential inflation bugs, which cannot be remediated. Zcash, for instance, had a typo in their specification, which many years later manifested in a potential inflation bug. Now, they don't actually know if it was exploited because, you know, the shielded pool in Zcash means you can't really see what's going on in there. So the privacy comes, it trades off against the auditability, privacy at the base layer. And so that's a really kind of significant thing to be aware of. Again, you know, I think privacy coins are basically a valid idea, but I would be very skeptical of incorporating this tech into Bitcoin as, you know, as it's currently understood.
Yes, and referring back to my previous show with Dan Herold, we discussed Bitcoin's monetary policy. And one of the most important things about it is the limited supply, the fact that it is 21 million. You know, if there is some hidden inflation bug that could potentially increase the 21 million, that actually devalues what is one of the main design points of Bitcoin.
Totally. And if anything, that's one of the most important characteristics of Bitcoin is not only the supply cap, but also the predictability and the credibility of the system. And an inflation bug would basically be catastrophic.
One of the things you did mention was a pre-mine, and that's probably going to come up later. We should probably explain what that is now, though, if somebody's just heard that, and what the problem with a pre-mine is.
Yeah, and so pre-mine is a word that specifically relates to mining, which is not how all of these things were issued, but then it kind of took on this broader meaning. So really, a pre-mine was a concept introduced in the early days after Bitcoin, when some of these altcoins were created, but the developers, you know, pre-mined, they basically allocated some fraction of supply to themselves as a reward for, you know, being these pioneering developers that created Bitcoin alternatives. And, you know, in my mind, that's a pretty illegitimate thing to do. Most people agreed in the early stages, and then later on, the notion of a pre-mine kind of became ratified and became socially acceptable. But, you know, my thinking on this is, if we're really talking about a monetary system that we want to scale that up to a global audience and user base, it's not a good idea to have any one entity in control of like 20% of the supply. Not only because that would make that person, you know, 10 times richer than Bezos if the money acquired global usage and that would delegitimize the system, but also because fairness is just a key variable which should be enshrined in the creation of these coins. And having deliberate unfairness, it seems to kind of compromise the project from its start. So my guess is the coins that do the best, like Bitcoin, are those that don't have this embedded unfairness in them. It makes them more likely to succeed. And also we can look at the history and see that some of these heavily pre-mined coins were outcompeted by fairer counterparts.
Okay, so the next up we have is essentially the smart contract platforms, the protocols, you know, the likes of Ethereum, EOS, and Cardano. And for me, going through my kind of history of Bitcoin and my experience with altcoins is that, you know, especially at my non-technical level, is that a couple of the problems that these seem to have is firstly adoption and two, scaling. And when people talk about decentralized being a spectrum, I've heard this a lot. I tend to look directionally where it's going. You know, when I look at Bitcoin, all the development choices seem to be considering the trade-offs for decentralization, you know, block size, mining. But it seems to me something like Ethereum directionally is becoming more centralized, which means it adds more risk.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the most important things when you design a cryptocurrency is to have easy verifiability so that a retail user, you know, a normal person like me or you, can verify the validity of an inbound payment. But to do this, you have to run a full node. You have to process the whole history of the transactions, process the whole ledger, and keep current with the chain tip to make sure that that transaction is valid. It's following the protocol rules. The more data you add onto there and the more computation you need your full node to run, the more difficult it is, the more costly it is to verify the validity of that inbound payment. So if we ever had a blockchain which had Visa levels of transactions, no one would be able to run that full node. You'd need a whole data center to do it. And so the system would be pretty useless in terms of maintaining decentralization and trustlessness. So that's like the key concept to keep in mind here. So, you know, Ethereum made a deliberate trade-off to have costlier validation, costlier full nodes, requiring more bandwidth, more computation, more, you know, space on your hard drive, in exchange to have more kind of scalability and expressivity at the base layer. And then some of these other coins, EOS in particular, took this concept and kind of did the reducto ad absurdum. They took it to an absurd degree. So running an EOS full archival node, I can tell you, thanks to my experience with Coinmetrics, is incredibly difficult, incredibly costly. So in some cases, this notion of user verification of the protocol, this idea was thrown out. And this is often the case in these smart contract platforms where there's really a deliberate attempt to make this trade-off. More expressivity, more scalability in exchange for much more expensive validation. And, you know, people criticize Ethereum for this, but it's actually not the worst offender by any means.
All right. So next up, we're going to have stablecoins. And again, this is an area which does have some validity around it, especially with many Bitcoiners, and especially, again, with Tether, because, you know, one of the problems that traders of Bitcoin had early on was having the ability for on and off ramps. But Tether gave people the ability to trade Bitcoin. So I still believe a lot of Bitcoiners believe there's a world where it's Bitcoin and Tether.
Yeah, people think that there's a contradiction in using blockchain rails to issue fiat-denominated assets, right? I actually don't think there's a contradiction. The stablecoin idea precedes Bitcoin. As we saw with Liberty Reserve and eGold, those were basically stablecoins. The only difference was they didn't exist on a blockchain. They exist in a more centralized manner. So there has always been, since the dawn of the internet, a demand to take regular dollars and make them digital, and then reduce the permissions around them. So give them the ease of use and the settlement guarantees of actual physical cash, but in a digital context, so that you could send your cash to your relative in the Philippines or Mexico. So this has always been a really seductive idea, and lots of entrepreneurs have tried to create this product. Stablecoins just leverage the, you know, the nice assurances that we have of blockchains to replicate this. However, they're subject to totally the same pitfalls as the predecessors like Liberty Reserve and eGold. There's always a central issuer, aside from in rare cases like MakerDai, where there's it's created in a different way. But so Tether, USDC, TrueUSD, Paxos, these are some of the better known stablecoins. For the most part, they all have an issuer that could all be compromised, and governments might lean on them to perform, you know, really aggressive KYC or to surveil the chain. So these are not a panacea, you know, and I think if there was a way to create stable value online, kind of fiat denominated, and that had been possible in a truly decentralized way, that's what we would have got instead of Bitcoin. And people would have been pretty happy with that because, you know, something people really like cryptocurrencies for is these large interjurisdictional transfers. Stablecoins are good for that. However, there's always this trust trade-off to be made.
All right, and the last one we're going to cover is utility tokens, of which exchange tokens really are just a utility token. We have the likes of BAT, Augur, 0x. So the biggest lesson for me here was, and this is where I think the world of cryptocurrency went completely lunatic in 2017, was there was two main problems I noticed with these. Firstly, it added friction into anything you wanted to do by having to go to an exchange to buy these tokens to access whatever utility they wanted to provide. And secondly, nobody really wants volatility with a utility product.
Yeah, so utility tokens, these follow from the philosophical tradition of beans and flues, which, as we've discussed, was deeply, deeply flawed. You know, it betrayed a total ignorance of economics and, you know, how consumers would engage with these things. And so most ICOs, they didn't want to be understood as securities by the regulators, so they didn't have dividend mechanics or anything. The theory was just that as usage of some online system or network increased, if there was a token required to use that system, the value of that token would appreciate and stabilize. This was the fundamental fallacy that we saw repeated hundreds of times in 2017, 18. It was just a nonsense idea. It's astounding to me that even one of these saw any uptake. And if you look at utility tokens today, virtually none of them have any usage whatsoever. Because of course, like, you don't stockpile gasoline in your basement before you go out for a road trip. You just buy it as you need it, as you're on the road, right? And so the utility token folks thought, well, if, you know, users need this computational resource, they're just going to, you know, buy it up in huge quantities beforehand. This didn't happen. And for the most part, these networks were totally abortive. Nobody used them. So yeah, the utility token was, in my mind, like the worst fallacy of the blockchain space in like the last 5 years.
All right, so let's get into the history of these altcoins. You know, so the listeners know, I mean, I started in 2016, so some of these predate me. You know, you're a bit earlier, but some of them predate you. So some of this isn't based on our history of experience at the time, but, you know, what we've learned since.
Yeah, I am going to be relying on my experience from about Dogecoin onwards. But prior to that, I had to do some archaeology. Yeah, so the 2011 through 2013 class of alts, I don't have any personal experience with. I'm just relying on my internet research skills.
All right, so Bitcoin launches January the 3rd, 2009, and it's a couple of years before we get the first altcoin. And my guess is in that reason is because it was probably 2000, 2011, that people started trading Bitcoin, so it started to have value, and the incentive then was there to create altcoins. I'm just going to go, that's a guess. And then we got the first one, which was Namecoin.
Yeah, so yeah, you're right. Nobody really cared about Bitcoin for the first year. In 2010, it got a bit of attention. And then, you know, even Satoshi was actually involved in the discussions around the protocol that would eventually become Namecoin. And, you know, what's interesting is, like, the very earliest altcoins were maybe some of the most interesting. And then they got kind of worse and worse as time went on. And then maybe there was some genuine innovation much, much later. But so Namecoin, it was first called BitDNS. So the idea was to have a domain name system with the data itself stored on a blockchain, right? So, you know, a domain name system is how we resolve URLs on the internet. And it's kind of done in a centralized way. So once the idea for Bitcoin had been proven out, it was kind of a logical extension to say, okay, well, here's another data structure that we all benefit from. It needs to be highly available. Wouldn't a blockchain be good for that? And so Namecoin was created in April 2011. And so it was a code-based fork of Bitcoin. So when I say code-based fork, I mean a new chain started from scratch using the code of Bitcoin, because Bitcoin was open source. You could reuse the code. And the idea was to create these .bit domains. You could buy them from the protocol for 0.01 Namecoins, and it was basically an alternative to the domain system. And interestingly, it was also the first example of merged mining. This meant that Bitcoin miners would also do a tiny little bit of extra work to mine Namecoin blocks. So its security became tethered to that of Bitcoin. And this is a concept that would become popular later on. The interesting thing is Namecoin, you know, didn't really catch on. And also, if you type a Namecoin domain into your URL, it won't work. You have to go through a lot of like configuration to get it to work. So you could try bitcoin.bit, which is a valid Namecoin domain. Odds are it won't work in your browser. So, you know, it didn't amount to much, but it was the first altcoin. And it had a, you know, financial value.
But conceptually, it seemed like a good idea. It seemed a valid, you know, experiment.
It's honestly not a terrible idea. I would question the need for an entirely new proof-of-work blockchain to pursue this idea. But yeah, this is a popular idea. There is Handshake, which isn't launched yet, is this same idea on steroids. Zilliqa is a smart contract chain. They built a domain system. There's a startup, Unstoppable Domains, doing that. So using blockchains as a DNS alternative is a pretty valid idea. I think it seems to me that lots of people are keen on doing that. So Namecoin was the first version of this.
All right, then we get Litecoin, which was a fork of Tenebrix. And some people actually confuse Litecoin. They think it's a fork of Bitcoin, but it's slightly different. It's a copy of the protocol.
Well, it's all descended from Bitcoin, right? But so this is where the distinction between codebase fork and kind of protocol fork comes into play. So Tenebrix was a codebase fork of Bitcoin. It had a pre-mine. I believe it had faster blocks and a different hash function, so script instead of SHA-256. And then Charlie Lee forked Tenebrix to create Fairbrix without the pre-mine. So that's the, as we were saying, sometimes the coins without pre-mines that were like identical clones of coins with pre-mines, they won. So this was an example. Although Fairbrix itself failed for a number of reasons. And so then Charlie Lee took that same code base, improved it a little bit, and created Litecoin. So Litecoin's value prop was, it seems kind of hilarious in hindsight, faster blocks, so the blocks came four times faster, and a different hash function, which meant that ASICs were going to be more difficult to create, although, of course, ASICs were ultimately created. And so Litecoin was a fork of Fairbrix, which was a fork of Tenebrix, which is a fork of Bitcoin. But yeah, I mean, it's a very, very, very similar code base to Bitcoin.
Again, I don't hold too much against Charlie for creating this because this is very early days for Bitcoin. It just seems like he was mucking around, playing with the code, just having a bit of fun. It was only later on that actually, you know, Litecoin actually ended up having some value. But a thing that was really interesting with Litecoin that proved to me, and, you know, I bought Litecoin quite early on and, you know, had a play with it. And, you know, it's been mistakenly called silver to Bitcoin's gold. But what it kind of proved to me is that, you know, there is a winner takes all with this kind of design.
Yeah, I mean, and silver to Bitcoin's gold, that was probably the first slogan for an altcoin. You know, that was marketing. I mean, does Bitcoin, like, Bitcoin is not literally gold. You know, silver existed because there wasn't really enough gold, and it wasn't, gold wasn't sufficiently divisible to create a metallic standard. So silver to Bitcoin's gold had this kind of implicit presumption that Bitcoin wasn't sufficiently divisible in some way, which is obviously nonsense. Like, one Satoshi is a really tiny amount. And so this is a great example of marketing really leading an undifferentiated coin to be super influential for a really, really long time. I mean, Litecoin has been in the top 10 or top 15 coins for a super long time. But yeah, I don't fault Charlie Lee too much. You know, he didn't pre-mine it, so he didn't give himself an unfair advantage. He created it in October 2011 when basically nobody cared about Bitcoin, so the stakes were super low. It's only much, much later that Litecoin actually grew into this big thing.
Next up, I talked to Nick Moore about the history of altcoins, but before that, I have a message from my amazing sponsors, and this is the last sponsorship for Kelman Law, so let's go out with a bang. Make sure you embed their name in your brain. If you've got any needs for lawyers related to Bitcoin and fintech, make sure it's Kelman Law that you reach out to. They are run by Bitcoin OGs out in New York, and other like these bullshit crypto lawyers you might find online. These guys totally get it. They understand Bitcoin. And also, do you know what? They accept Bitcoin as payment. That is skin in the game. One of the partners, Zachary Kelman, is known for drafting a bill submitted to US Congress in 2014. It was aimed at exempting on-chain Bitcoin transactions from US regulations. The other founding partner, Daniel Kelman, he was on my show as part of my Mt. Gox series, helping me understand some of the complexities around civil rehabilitation. The Kelman Law team is staffed with lawyers with expertise in litigation, dispute resolution, anti-money laundering, and US and international corporate structuring for fintech businesses or companies and individuals in the Bitcoin space. So listen, if you operate a fintech business, if you've got a dispute involving Bitcoin, maybe some fucker owes you some Bitcoin, or you need some legal advice related to Bitcoin or fintech, open up your email, send a message to info@kelman.law. That is K-E-L-M-A-N.law. Kelman with one L, not two, or just head over to their website, www.kelman.law. And today's show is also brought to you by Dropbit, the only mobile wallet I use for sending and receiving Bitcoin. Have you downloaded it yet? Have you tried it out? I've got it with me. I've been using it this last couple of days. I'm out in Latvia. I have had my wallet with me. It's such a great way to send and receive Bitcoin when you're out on the move. They are the Venmo of Bitcoin. They really, really are. That's what they told me at the very start. They're like, Pete, we're the Venmo of Bitcoin. I was like, what's Venmo? And they're like, well, go check it out. We don't have Venmo in the UK, but immediately understand what they were saying. They wanted to make the sending and receiving of Bitcoin as easy as possible, and they have killed it. They have killed it. You can send and receive with your usual stuff, with your QR codes, with your normal address, but you can tweet Bitcoin and you can text Bitcoin, and they also integrated Lightning into this. Dropbit is the best Bitcoin wallet out there. I love it. If you've not downloaded it, then what are you doing with your life? Go and check it out today. It's available for the iPhone and Android. Just head over to dropbit.app, which is dropbit.app. All right, in 2012, we're gonna talk about Ripple now, XRP. Now, again, this is a very interesting one because you will find very significant communities around XRP, like crazy passionate cultists who absolutely love it. You know, they love things such as the speed of XRP. They think it's like Bitcoin, but so much better. You know, for me personally, it kind of proves a number of things. Firstly, it proves that, you know, people can easily be sucked into the marketing of something. Secondly, it proves to me that people are often incentivized financially for a project to succeed way beyond what it means for society as a whole.
Yeah, to me, Ripple is the greatest beneficiary of the creation of Bitcoin outside of Bitcoin, basically. So Ripple predated Bitcoin, the kind of corporation that became Ripple predated Bitcoin. After Ripple had took off, Ripple itself created a token kind of modeled on Bitcoin, kind of implying that it had the same guarantees and assurances as Bitcoin. And then that token took off because there was a single firm involved in marketing this thing and getting partnerships. So they were the most transparent project in terms of just like really deliberately pushing a narrative that they thought would cause the price to appreciate. And this was their business model, and it has been their business model, you know, for about a decade now. And they've sold over $1 billion of this 100% pre-mined, 100% pre-mined token to the general public. And so like the Ripple folks will push back and they'll say, oh, well, you know, we actually quote unquote discovered, or the leadership of Ripple discovered XRP, or they gifted it to the corporation. I factually dispute that. So I believe if you look at the history, you know, the co-founders, Chris Larson, Jed McCaleb, and Arthur Brito, they created 100 billion XRP in 2012. 20 billion went to themselves, 80 billion went to OpenCoin. OpenCoin became Ripple Labs in 2013. So as far as I'm concerned, the IP, the coins, have always been owned by the corporate entity, as opposed to this alternative narrative. But really, you know, Ripple is not decentralized. It has no proof of work. It just relies on this kind of consensus mechanism involving large nodes. And if you actually try and run a Ripple node, it's really, really interesting and eye-opening. So we tried to run one for Coinmetrics to do blockchain analytics, and it ended up being more efficient to get a mailed hard drive version of the Ripple ledger history as opposed to hitting the API and downloading the history. So you could say the Ripple runs on the sneaker net because they will offer to mail you a hard drive with all of the ledger data in there. Because it's too difficult and too burdensome to download it all. Because there's like terabytes and terabytes of data there. Bitcoin, by contrast, is about 200 gigabytes. So running a Ripple node is really not a viable thing for an end user. And there's no Nakamoto consensus. There's no proof of work. So in my opinion, it's not meaningfully decentralized. So the assurances that you get by using the chain are very weak. It's always been marketed as something which is similar to Bitcoin, has its properties in some way. But in my view, that's just not right.
Yeah. Okay, so next we're going to talk about Frycoin. Is that how it's pronounced?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about Frycoin just because it's an interesting example of how these things fail, not just for technical reasons, but for economic reasons.
So I've never heard of it.
Yeah, so I liked it as a case study just because. So it started in 2012. Developed by Mark Friedenbach, who actually is a Bitcoin developer, or has been. Frycoin is an example of a coin with an interesting economic idea, which was an experiment and turned out to be really bad. So people always like criticize Bitcoin by saying it's deflationary, it doesn't encourage people to spend, so the Bitcoin economy will never develop. I think that's empirically false. You know, it's a very kind of Keynesian idea that like you have to induce people to spend for the economy to work. Bitcoin is a rebellion against this. So Frycoin is a rebellion against Bitcoin's rebellion. And they introduced this concept of demurrage, which just means each coin would decline or lose purchasing power by 5% every year. So it had a disincentive to hold it. And it meant that the developers wanted people to spend it. But of course, this got outcompeted by Bitcoin because like it would never hold value if it had this deliberate disincentive to spend. So that's just an interesting example of a coin which failed for, you know, economic reasons as opposed to technical.
Okay, next up we get Mastercoin. And, you know, Mastercoin is one of these projects that I've, you know, heard a lot about. I don't know too much about it, but again, it had credibility when it was launched.
Yeah, and Mastercoin is notable because it was the first ICO, the first ICO with Bitcoin contributions. And, you know, I think it's such an interesting case study. It was actually very successful in its own way, but of course the value of the token went to essentially zero. So that's the lesson. Even if the protocol introduced by this coin is incredibly wildly successful, that doesn't guarantee that the token itself will have value. That's the takeaway from Mastercoin. So this guy, J.R. Willett, went on the Bitcoin Talk Forum in 2013 and said, I want to create an asset issuance protocol on top of Bitcoin, a decentralized exchange on top of Bitcoin. I need some money to do it. Would you send me a donation? And so he collected $500,000 worth of Bitcoin. And he also said, and if you donate to this project, you'll get a little token called a Mastercoin. And maybe even those tokens will have some special privileges within this new system. This was a utility token. This was the first ICO'd utility token. And it wasn't exactly clear what the privileges were. There ended up not being any. I like it as well because he actually put risk disclosures in the prospectus. Like when you look at a real IPO prospectus, they put risk disclosures, you know. Almost never in ICOs do you see disclosures of risk because there is no requirement to do that, right? But so, you know, where this is the first ICO and the issuer was saying, yeah, actually, it's actually quite risky. It could fail for these reasons. You know, I kind of like that. I think he maybe had a little bit more authenticity and credibility compared to some of these later ICO issuers. But so what Mastercoin actually did was it created this Omni protocol, which is what Tether was issued on. So this asset issuance protocol, it was basically a way to keep track of assets by including data in the op return transactions in Bitcoin, which is just an arbitrary data field. So just a different transactional type. And Tether, of course, ended up mediating hundreds of billions of dollars in transactions and doing tens and tens of millions of transactions. So Mastercoin became Omni, which was used by Tether, which is the most successful, stablecoin, really. But, you know, despite all that, the coin issued by J.R. Willett in 2013 on Bitcoin Talk, you know, has no real usage. It never manifested, you know, any value accrual as a utility token. Didn't work.
It's quite interesting that the first ICO to ever launch is probably the most professionally put together of all of them.
Well, I mean, it was pretty amateurish, but he just was a little bit more sensible than some of his successors, for sure, with the risk disclosures. But, you know, he couldn't figure out the value accrual thing, which would be a theme repeated hundreds and hundreds of times.
Yeah, especially in 2017, 2018. Okay, let's
and
go to
it was one of the most successful. It was one of the most successful. Like, he created the Omni protocol, which got a ton of usage. That's, like, the amazing thing, you know? And then, like, most of the subsequent ICOs didn't produce anything at all.
Well, that's potentially a good case study for the future value of Ethereum, which we will come to. But next, we're going to talk about Peercoin, because this was the first proof-of-stake coin, right? And we should just do a very quick discussion between proof of work, proof of stake. Because if somebody is first hearing this, going to be, well, what does proof of stake mean? Why should I care?
Yeah, so Peercoin, we're just doing all the firsts, which is great because Peercoin it's a great example of why this like virtue signaling argument against Bitcoin being environmentally costly doesn't work. because people don't make moral assessments when they make investment decisions. They make economic and financial assessments, right? So Peercoin was started by this guy, Sonny King, pseudonymous. Nobody knows who it is. There's actually some conspiracies that it's a well-known Bitcoin developer, but I really don't know who it is. It was the first implementation of this idea of proof of stake, which meant that your rewards in the kind of not mining, but like the validation, the issuance of new coins, your rewards would be proportional to the fraction of supply that you owned. So if you owned 50% of supply, you would get 50% of rewards. Of course, this is different from proof of work, which stipulates that your rewards in mining are proportional to the fraction of hash power that you have. And hash power requires committing real world resources to the problem, electricity, which you have to burn to produce a block. In proof of stake, by contrast, it's meant to be quote unquote greener because you don't have to burn anything. All you have to do is show that you had a certain fraction of coins. This actually gave rise to a lot of problems. There is this nothing at stake problem whereby it was costless to produce alternative histories, which isn't present in proof of work. So the creation of proof of stake coins allowed us to evaluate whether proof of stake was like a viable idea or not. And even stretching all the way back to 2012, it became pretty clear that proof of stake introduced a whole new class of problems that aren't present in proof of work. And so what happened actually was it became hyper-centralized. And because of the nothing at stake problem, the Peercoin developers had these central checkpoints just signing the blocks. So there became basically one single node that mattered in the whole blockchain. And, you know, like lots of the subsequent proof of stake developers will say they fixed this problem. But this was a great example of how this like environmental argument, A, isn't convincing because it never caught on. And B, how introducing an alternative consensus or Sybil resistance mechanism can cause all sorts of unforeseen problems.
And I think the other thing is you can wrap in the pre-mine here. If you have a pre-mine and then have a proof of stake consensus mechanism, you are essentially, when you're creating money, you're essentially, it's like you referred to earlier, it creates bad incentives.
Not just that, but you become the oligarch of that system, you know? So you can assign yourself 30% of the coins. And then from then on, you have 30% of the power in the system in perpetuity. You have a costless advantage in perpetuity. You basically have the ability to transform economic power into political power, which in my view is a really bad thing. That's the way that our current government works. If you're rich, if you're Michael Bloomberg, you can kind of buy your way into relevance. I think that shouldn't be the case in cryptocurrency. It's not the case in Bitcoin. You know, if you have lots of Bitcoins, that doesn't automatically mean that you have influence, but in a proof of stake system, it does.
Yeah, and then you can wrap it up and make it even worse. As something becomes more centralized, if you have the pre-mine and proof of stake and have influence over the monetary policy, you essentially, if Ethereum was to become money for the world, you're more than an oligarch.
The early Ethereans would be in control of virtually everything. And I generally feel it's best to have financial wealth be a totally distinct concept from political power. Of course, you can always sort of transform the two by doing lobbying and so on. But I really find it elegant that Bitcoin, no matter how much Bitcoin you have, the protocol will basically treat you in the same way.
All right. So tell me about Primecoin. I don't know much about Primecoin. I do remember it when I first came in.
So it was also created by Sonny King.
Okay.
And Primecoin was also an innovation or claimed innovation on proof of work. It introduced this concept of useful proof of work. So people really, another thing people don't like about, you know, Bitcoin is that the hashes are quote unquote wasted. Of course, then you have to explain to them why it's actually important to have this cost be remunerated only in the form of Bitcoins. This is what actually keeps Bitcoin secure, that all miners have this sunk cost element. But so Primecoin didn't like that, and they decided that the proof of work would be used for finding long chains of prime numbers, which actually isn't that useful either, which is kind of funny. So they found what are called Cunningham chains of prime numbers. There's no scientific use for these. There may be one day. But so Primecoin actually found a bunch of prime numbers, you know. So congrats to them for that, I guess. But yeah, this useful proof of work idea did not catch on at all.
All right, so now 2014, we get Realcoin, which is Tether.
Yeah, so this is one of the most controversial coins ever.
Yes.
It was set up by Brock Pierce, who would later be part of EOS, Craig Sellers, who I believe was on the Bitcoin Foundation. So it was issued on Omni. It was issued on MasterCoin, as I said. In January 2015, Tether became a way to get dollar exposure on Bitfinex. So you'd basically wire these guys some dollars, and you would get Tethers, which were representations of dollars, which existed on Bitcoin, which you could trade using the Bitcoin infrastructure. So that was pretty interesting, although it was very small for a long time. It ended up being kind of folded into the Bitfinex entity. So Phil Potter of Bitfinex set up Tether Limited in the British Virgin Islands, which became a subsidiary of the Bitfinex parent company. And so Tether became a way for Bitfinex to create liquidity, basically between traders and itself and between Bitfinex and other exchanges. So it took something which didn't really exist, was dollars, and it transformed them and made them useful in the crypto system, in the crypto financial system. And this was actually a hell of an innovation, basically. I mean, it meant that traders could hold their capital in a, roughly speaking, stable currency like dollars instead of being exposed to Bitcoin all the time. So from that perspective, it was pretty useful. However, it did rely on these single points of failures, these central issuers, basically banks that would hold the actual dollars somewhere. And this is where all the trouble began. I don't think we have to go into the whole history of Tether, but basically they had to use these shady payment processors who ripped them off to the tune of $850 million. And then Tether made a really catastrophic mistake, which was remediating that theft by basically taking capital off Bitfinex's balance sheet, which led to a run on Tether. So people thought that Tether was insolvent, which it basically was for a while, which meant that it traded well below the $1 peg. Although Tether today seems to have recovered from that, and it's worth about $4.5 billion. So Tether is one of the success stories of crypto, I would say, and all of the other stablecoins. That said, it's had an extremely checkered past, and it's still fighting with regulators. So that's the issue with these stablecoins. They're always dependent on these single points of failures, the banks.
Right, now we get into the world of privacy currencies. And I know there was like some early ideas, but we get Dash and Monero, which both now exist as, you know, very well respected projects. And I say that within the world of crypto people, but they were two attempts at bringing privacy to crypto.
Yeah, so I think Monero, the history of Monero is absolutely fascinating. Mm-hmm. So Monero is also a code base fork of a project called Bytecoin, B-Y-T-E coin. And Bytecoin appears to have been a deliberate scam from inception. So it introduced this really interesting technology, this notion of confidential transactions, which is a different cryptographic primitive, basically, or cryptographic system, which hid the balances. So that was really interesting. However, Bytecoin had this enormous embedded pre-mine, which the developers had tried to hide, and then they issued this backdated white paper to claim that they'd been around in 2012, which they hadn't. And all of this was in service of trying to hide a pre-mine. So Bytecoin was a very sophisticated attempted scam, which it was a shame because they also introduced some really interesting tech. So like you'd have thought that they could just have produced a new protocol without including the scam element. But, you know, be that as may, some folks saw the code base, thought it was interesting. They forked it. They created Monero. So Monero, you know, it's been around for a long time. They've had some issues in terms of linkability. There are definitely adversarial ways to link together outputs and maybe break the privacy a little bit. But overall, it's like pretty private, I would say. The amounts are hidden. So you wouldn't be able to see on a Block Explorer how much Monero I had, you know, in a single output or address. And also the transactions have this plausible deniability. So it's hard to see which prior transaction led to the next transaction. So it's, I would say, as far as privacy coins go, it's the most adopted on the place that matters for privacy coins, which is the dark web. So the dark web. So if you look at any of these dark web marketplaces, aside from Bitcoin, the most popular coin will be Monero. It's the most popular of the privacy coins there. So these dark web marketplaces aren't as big as they were, but that's always one way to evaluate what the people with lots and lots of, you know, money and reputation at stake, I guess, what they think of the various privacy coins. So it seems to be the most respected among those kind of underground circles, which I don't know if that's good or bad, right? By contrast, Dash was a more checkered project, I'd say, probably less successful. So Dash did have a pre-mine, but is in the form of an Instamine. So what that meant was the initial software released to mine the coin upon launch didn't work. So the few insiders that had the correct software, they were able to mine a lot of Dash coins. And then the other interesting thing about Dash is Dash introduced this notion of masternodes, which meant that there were some privileged nodes in the systems. So by locking up 1,000 Dash in a single node, you could basically have control over system parameters. So those were called masternodes, and those were compensated. Not only the mining would compensate you, but also the masternodes would. Anyway, the point was, if you had a lot of Dash, you had a lot of control over the system, and you could also get a financial reward for that. So it was kind of an extractive mechanism. And also the privacy elements on Dash didn't work very well. Dash is held, I would say, in much lower regard generally.
All right, next we're going to talk about Dogecoin. And this is one you struggle to say without smiling when you consider the history of it, some of the things it's been involved in, the community around it. You know, I would love myself to do almost like a documentary about Dogecoin and the community, because it is just so funny.
It is funny. And this was like, remember, this was 2013 when like the Bitcoin community really was pretty small and it didn't take itself seriously, but it was just on the cusp of maybe growing into something more significant, right? And Dogecoin was just at that transition phase when stuff was really still playful and fun, at least from my perspective. And also the financial clout was sufficiently large that you could actually do things that mattered. So I think Dogecoin was really the first time people realized that through altcoins, you could pool your finances and actually kind of make a difference, albeit in some kind of like marginal ways. So Dogecoin was basically a fork of Litecoin with faster blocks. It wasn't interesting from a data or from a technology perspective, but and it was a meme. Like Dogecoin was like Doge itself was like a sort of silly meme from back in the day. And the idea that a coin based on this meme could be worth hundreds of millions of dollars, that was basically the joke. And it was like pretty entertaining for a while. I really got my start mining Dogecoin, tipping people on Reddit. I thought that was pretty funny. They ended up doing crowdfunding to sponsor a NASCAR car. So the community thought it was absolutely hilarious to get like the Dogecoin logo on the front hood of a NASCAR vehicle. And they actually sponsored the Jamaican bobsled team to pay for them to go to the Olympics. So they did like funny marketing stunts like that. It was a very collegiate, atmosphere. And I think that was like one of the first times that like an altcoin community developed, realized that they had some financial clout, basically.
I think one of the most interesting things for me with Dogecoin as well is when I first started doing the podcast, going around meeting people, one of the questions you usually ask people is, how did you get into Bitcoin? And so many people got into Bitcoin through Dogecoin.
Yeah, it was like a gateway drug kind of thing. I remember thinking to myself like, wow, I would go to the Bitcoin subreddit on Reddit and be like, oh, these guys are so serious. They're talking about like monetary history and stuff. And like, I don't care about any of that stuff, or I didn't back then. And what I did care about was like micropayments and like tipping people online and like having a good time with my pals, So Dogecoin was like a great like first coin for me to care about. And that's what led me to Bitcoin.
All right. So it's going to start getting a bit more serious now. Some of the projects that people are most likely to see and possibly be tempted by. So we're going to talk now about Ethereum, because that's going to be, we could probably say that's the second most credible project in cryptocurrency, if you consider anything outside of Bitcoin credible.
Yeah. And, Ethereum's very divisive. Lots of, longtime Bitcoiners really don't like it because they don't like the way it was marketed or sold, or the fact that there was pre-mine. But, if you consider reality, Ethereum has a ton of people building things on it. It seems to have delivered on at least some of its promises. And it seems to have really captured the imagination of a lot of you know, developers, maybe in a slightly different way from Bitcoin. You know, so Bitcoin was always this really serious project about tilting at the state's monetary privilege and creating a monetary system free from debasement and so on. The central idea behind Ethereum was, well, what if we had a similar system to that, but we enabled permissionless applications at a big scale on the internet? The interesting thing was the original vision for Ethereum didn't really pan out, I would say. Like, they did realize that scalability was just this like inherent trade-off on blockchains, and you couldn't put too much data on chain. So this unstoppable applications idea didn't really pan out at the mass scale like they envisioned. However, Ethereum proved useful for other things like quote-unquote decentralized finance, so basically creating derivatives and different flavors of risk on-chain. You know, so I would say Ethereum got by far the most traction of any alternative to Bitcoin. And my guess is that it'll exist for the foreseeable future. It's definitely had a ton of scandals as well. Ethereum had a charismatic leader, Vitalik Buterin, and, you know, Bitcoiners would always point to that as a central point of failure, right? Like, if Ethereum became big enough, presumably various nation states would try to interfere with it or co-opt it in some way, and they have a very obvious access to do this based on the Ethereum Foundation and Vitalik. But that was always the way that Ethereum operated, basically making these deliberate trade-offs, kind of going against everything that Bitcoin has held dear. But, you know, despite it all, it seemed to work, basically. And I think Ethereans are awake to the fact that they've made these significant trade-offs in terms of centralization, interfering in the protocol more, or changing it more frequently, making these political discretionary one-off decisions, like the bailout of the DAO, which was this really infamous event, and by having, you know, this leadership, so, and having a pre-mine. So, like, those are all axes in which it differs from Bitcoin really significantly and, like, totally violates the, like, Bitcoin philosophy and so on. But I do think it's at the state where the two projects can basically coexist.
Yeah, and one of the things we have to consider is that, you know, you, I, and many other Bitcoiners talk about the fact that there is a role for stablecoins. You know, stablecoins do have a valid role in this essential crypto world, and pretty much all of them are Ethereum-based.
For the most part, yeah. Although Tether still exists on Bitcoin partially, and about $800 million of Tether exists on Tron, of all places.
Yeah.
But for the most part, all the other stablecoins are on Ethereum. Yeah, Ethereum has a different class of innovation. You might say that it's not worth it in terms of the trade-offs it makes. You know, that's certainly a valid critique. And you also might say it's like a less essential task. Like, you know, Bitcoin's task is to fix the money. It's not clear what Bitcoin's core task is to do. I don't think its like killer app has actually been developed yet. You know, we'll see.
All right, now we're going to talk about Zcash, which is different from other privacy coins in that has optional privacy, which also technically seems like something interesting, but theoretically proves to be kind of stupid.
Well, Monero has default privacy, although you could say that the two privacies aren't necessarily interchangeable. So Zcash was created by Zuko. Zuko was an early cypherpunk. He was around on the mailing list long before Bitcoin was created. Zuko worked at DigiCash, as I said. He has a very long history in the digital cash space and the privacy space.
And you would also say, you know, having worked with David Chaum on privacy, you know, this is probably something that is passionate towards him. I don't believe Zuko is somebody who wants to create a coin just to scam people.
No, yeah, his credentials are unimpeachable. Unimpeachable. Just about the best credentials you could have in the digital cash industry. He clearly authentically cares about this stuff. I happen to know him personally. I believe his motives are pure, for sure. Zcash itself is a bit more controversial. So set up, I believe, in 2014 to finance the development of the cryptography, they took investment, you know, from individuals and firms, which meant that there was basically, I believe, 20% of the supply was allocated to this kind of founder's reward. It might be 10% of the supply. I need to double check that. But so there was this element of a founder's reward, which was basically a pre-mine which vested over time as the rewards were mined. So a fraction of each block was vested over time to the founders and to the company which was set up. So people don't like that because, or Bitcoiners don't like it because they believe that this is a critical vector of centralization and that it's also unfair to have anything that resembles a pre-mine. However, that said, you know, like they developed some pretty interesting, innovative cryptography, these zero-knowledge proofs, which have now taken over and are an incredibly popular area of experimentation. So they do have optional privacy. So in practice, Zcash is mostly used in a non-private way, I would say. So that could be one critique of Zcash. I think the biggest difficulty for them is this governance issue, where you have this pot of money and it's not clear what to do with it. The corporation had an entitlement to it for a while, and now the community is kind of rebelling against that. So there's a lot of rancor, a lot of really heated discussion over that. And that's, you know, a function of the fact that they had this centralization at inception.
All right, so let's talk next about Bitcoin Cash. We got that in 2017, I believe August the 1st, by memory, but perhaps I'm wrong. But this is probably the most controversial alternative project in Bitcoin. It created a split in the community, a lot of anger, a lot of fighting, but itself is a, you know, is a very key lesson in Bitcoin.
And you have to remember that Bitcoin Cash is the consequence of probably 5 years of arguments over the block size and of over really over who is in control of the Bitcoin system. And so, you know, Satoshi had instituted this 1 megabyte block size cap in Bitcoin. Some people thought it was a problem, especially people whose businesses depended on there being low fees in the Bitcoin system. Other people didn't think it was a problem. They thought Bitcoin needs to have fees at maturity. I'm in that camp, full disclosure. I think for Bitcoin to survive long term and for the block rewards to transition away from the subsidy and towards a fee-driven model, Bitcoin needs to keep its block space capped. But the Bitcoin Cash people, for the most part, they didn't agree with this. And, you know, Gavin Anderson was one of the main proponents behind this idea. He created this alternative version of Bitcoin called Bitcoin XT in 2015, which had no block size, right? So Bitcoin Cash was an outgrowth of this idea. And it had been an argument in a civil war, which was a really long time running and split the Bitcoin community. Although I would say the vast majority of core developers were on the capped block size front. And so after SegWit, which was an improvement to Bitcoin, which would have allowed the Lightning Network to be developed, which was the kind of the orthodox Bitcoin's favored scaling mechanism. After that happened, some miners basically created this alternative version of Bitcoin called Bitcoin Cash. And that was not a code base fork. That was, you know, a protocol fork, a chain split. So they basically created a version of Bitcoin which was incompatible with the prior history, but it did inherit the entire UTXO set. So it took the state of Bitcoin, all the account balances, and it just created a new chain based on that, with the idea that they would have bigger blocks and more commerce and so on. Empirically, I think the idea has been a failure because Bitcoin Cash is only worth something like 3% of what Bitcoin itself is worth. So like the market really assessed its value as being vanishingly small relative to Bitcoin. But for a while, Bitcoin Cash like looked like it might potentially overtake Bitcoin. It was worth, you know, $4,000 for a while on Coinbase. There was a lot of support behind this notion of unbounded block space. But I think eventually the market basically realized that block space had to be capped and that miners were not unilaterally in control of Bitcoin. Developers matter, economic nodes matter. You know, so this was really an experiment in both governance and also the technical realities of block size.
And through 2017, 2018, we had this bull run. But this bull run was this crazy market where we were getting new coins and tokens issued weekly, like tens. And it was relentless. And there's no point discussing all of them because, well, firstly, there's far too many. But I think the one we can discuss, which is the epitome of all of this, is EOS.
Yeah, totally. So EOS is is the token which raised, or the ICO, which raised the most amount of money. In fact, it's probably the biggest crowd sale of anything in history. You know, so like if you look before cryptocurrency existed, there were some big crowd sales. Like there's this space MMORPG, which raised a few hundred million dollars. I'm trying to remember what it was called. Wish I could remember. But all of that was eclipsed by like a full order of magnitude by EOS. And EOS wasn't the only one. There were many ICOs. I think the ICO fever really kicked into gear in like spring 2017. That seems like the time when it really kicked off like crazy. Keep in mind, most of these ICOs were happening on Ethereum because it was kind of like really convenient to submit Ether into a crowd sale contract and for it to spit out a different token. So that was one of Ethereum's early like killer use cases, was enabling these permissionless capital formation to occur. Of course, most of these projects were totally without merit. EOS was the most ambitious one. So the founder of EOS is this guy, Dan Larimer. Previously, he'd founded this blockchain social network called Steemit, which actually had some usage, although the token didn't amount to much. And before that, he'd founded BitShares, which was BitShares had issued some of the first algorithmic stable coins, fun fact. And I think it had a decentralized exchange. So Larimer had a history of creating these alternative blockchains, crucially not in a proof of work protocol manner, but with a delegated proof of stake. So basically appointing certain nodes to be the guardians of the network and, you know, throwing away this notion of like decentralization at the protocol layer. So basically appointing certain super nodes and they would be in control of the network. And so EOS had some quote unquote revolutionary ideas. So there wouldn't be any transaction fees. You would have to, your ability to use EOS would be a function of the amount of EOS you held, which would entitle you to the computational resources of the system. There wouldn't be any mining or proof of work. There would just be essentially 21 nodes that signed all the blocks. And these nodes would be appointed democratically through voting. You can kind of see where some of the issues might result there. The other thing was they wanted to have kind of human governance in the system. They wanted to have the discretion to have these nodes have a political process of like really a bureaucratic process of like blacklisting certain accounts and having recourse if transactions went bad, which again, you can really easily imagine how this would be abused or go bad. And so from about spring 2017 through to spring 2018, EOS took donations into this contract. The questionable thing was they had outflows from that contract during the same period, which a lot of people criticized them for, because that meant that they could recycle Ether deposited into the EOS crowd sale contract in a circular way, take that Ether and deposit it in their own crowd sale, which effectively that would give them an arbitrary amount of the supply of EOS. So they could basically buy their own ICO if they wanted. There's no evidence they did this, but it's basically impossible to disprove. So this was a cloud of suspicions that hung over the project for a long time. So they raised about $4 billion. They launched EOS. And then, you know, like, interestingly, a lot of people thought they would be slapped down by the U.S. regulators, the securities regulators, because this thing looked like a security, right? But earlier this year in 2019, they actually settled up with the U.S. regulators for a really small fine, only $25 million. So this was the biggest ever ICO, and they basically got away scot-free. Now, you know, the EOS system itself, like, has a lot of problems. This governance forum thing they had didn't work, and there's now allegations that all of these block producers are colluding with each other, forming cartels, which is very foreseeable. And the resource system they developed doesn't seem to work very well. But EOS is the greatest example of, you know, optimism and techno-utopianism and hubris that the crypto world has ever seen, both in terms of the size of the raise and like the scale of their ambitions. So it's a really interesting case study, even if, you know, the project itself, you know, doesn't work that well. Oh, and the other thing I'll note is that it's virtually impossible to run an EOS full archival node. Virtually impossible. I've tried.
All right, so the last one we're going to cover in this history of altcoins is Bitcoin Private, which also has a checkered past.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about Bitcoin Private because I gotta phrase this carefully. I like Bitcoin Private because it's an example of how things can go terribly wrong in the case of an altcoin. So Bitcoin Private was interesting in that it merged the UTXO sets of Bitcoin and Z Classic. Z Classic was a fork of Zcash. So it's already very exotic. And it was the idea was to take the Bitcoin UTXO set and give everyone the ability to use Zcash style transactions. So you can see how these altcoins are being recombined and mixed and mashed all together. So, you know, maybe that was a valid idea. Who knows? What happened was during the import process, there was 10% covert inflation, which went to an address, which was not anticipated or planned for. And it didn't go discovered for about 9 months. So 10% extra supply was printed out of thin air and deposited in a specific address. Nobody knows who had it. And it also went undiscovered. So then the Coinmetrics folks did a routine audit of supply and found this. They found, they found that the supply wasn't what the leadership claimed. And then at that point, the leadership of Bitcoin Private said they were really shocked by this. They didn't know it had happened. I don't know who to believe. You know, they claim it was an exploit. Other people think they were involved. Who knows? But I thought that was such an interesting case study because then that led to like a chain of events that basically caused the dissolution of the coin. So the developers, in response to this, actually burned the shielded pool on Z Classic to reduce the supply. And that actually burned some of the coins held by exchanges, including HitBTC. So they didn't ask these exchanges if they had coins in that shielded pool. So HitBTC did, and it caused them to lose money. So then HitBTC delisted Bitcoin Private in protest. Bitcoin Private had paid HitBTC for that listing, and so they sued them. That's how we know this, because there's a lawsuit. So, and then, you know, that was their main liquidity provider, and that led to the demise of the coin. But so there are countless examples of coins like this, projects like this, where there's some catastrophic failure, there's some information asymmetry, where the public don't know about this stuff, and maybe the insiders in the coin do know. This is just one of dozens and dozens and dozens of case studies of coins that fail in interesting or unexpected ways, which cause retail investors to lose money, right? Like, you know, Bitcoin Private was worth $2 billion or over $1 billion at one point. So, you know, it wasn't like a tiny project. And, you know, it's not a particularly notable coin, but I just thought it was an interesting case study in how these things are very fragile, you know? And just because Bitcoin was successful doesn't mean that an altcoin built on the Bitcoin code base will be successful.
Right. I do want to talk about one future coin. There's so many coins we could talk about, but one future coin, and I don't even know if to call it an altcoin, but it's Libra. We should just touch on that very quickly.
Totally. So, you know, we've talked a lot about stable coins today. There were quote unquote stable coins that existed before Bitcoin. Bitcoin itself facilitated the rise of stable coins. Libra takes this concept, privately issued money, to the extreme. You know, Libra is intended to be issued by Facebook or a consortium run by Facebook. And the basic idea is to have a basket of sovereign currencies, which is managed by this consortium. And then the value of that basket creates a unit of account, you know, a digital coin, which could then be used by all of Facebook's users all over the world. Facebook has like 2.5 billion users. So the idea is to take, fiat and render it digital and very transferable, kind of seamlessly transferable, and, you know, give retail individuals all over the world this seamless transactional experience with the idea that it would bring commerce to places like, you know, Indonesia and India and so on. Now, it hasn't launched yet because the regulators are pretty skeptical of this idea. You know, they don't really necessarily want a private company to be issuing money. They tend to think that's the job of the government. Of course, that hasn't stopped people doing it in the crypto context without permission. Libra maybe made the mistake of asking for permission first. But if they can pull it off, it would be one of the bigger events in the history of cryptocurrency, especially because they'll probably be using a lot of the infrastructure that's been built to support Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. You know, like, we'll see how permissionless it becomes and whether they let it be used with third-party wallets and so on. But if it launches, it's like a huge validation of this idea of non-state money being created. Now, lots of Bitcoiners don't like it. They think dollar-backed or sovereign currency-backed money is boring, and the whole thing that's interesting thing, the interesting thing here is to create a new monetary standard that's independent of a government. So, like, I'm sympathetic to that idea, but I also think that Libra is the first case of a whole class of new corporate monies that will exist, likely exist, as a consequence of the founding of Bitcoin in 2009, which reopened the Overton window, made it acceptable to dream of creating a new money, even if you're a corporation. So from that perspective, it's pretty interesting.
And probably one of the most viable, whether or not people like it or not.
For sure, because we've never had an enormous corporation like Facebook try, not in the modern era really, try and issue their own currency. So it's like a throwback to like the days of yore before we had central banks, back when banks themselves issued currencies that were free-floating and traded against each other. So maybe we are returning to the kind of the pre-Civil War era in the US.
So listen, that's obviously a very good history, and it goes in line with what we said. It's really a history of failure. I personally, you know, I adore Bitcoin. I believe Ethereum, like you, will probably exist whatever I think of it or not. And I do think there's a role for maybe, you know, stable coins, but maybe just one stable coin. I think that's just a reality check. But, you know, again, why do you think there's been such a high failure rate?
Well, because it shouldn't be easy to create a new money. And Bitcoin shouldn't have succeeded. You know, it succeeded against all odds. Like, every digital cash prior to Bitcoin had failed miserably, and the founders went to jail. And then Satoshi comes along with this revolutionary idea and says, well, what if we decentralize everything and no one's in charge? That is the only reason Bitcoin succeeded. But even despite that, it had a very brittle and risky, you know, early days. Like, Bitcoin had an inflation bug, it had a rollback, you know, its largest exchange, Mt. Gox, collapsed. It could have failed in a myriad of ways. And it's absolutely amazing that it succeeded. So many altcoins took that model of Bitcoin as this behemoth, and they just presumed that they could kind of piggyback on its success. But the truth is that, like, the hardest problem is maybe not even technical. It's just convincing the world that you've created a valid alternative money. And just because it's technically maybe easy to do that in the wake of Bitcoin does not mean it's politically or economically a viable idea. So it's not surprising to me that virtually all of these altcoins have failed. That should be the default. New monies shouldn't come around every day. You know, when was the last time like a non-sovereign currency came into existence? Like, gold, you know, is the only one I can think of, and that's been around for thousands and thousands of years. So unfortunately, or fortunately, the world we live in today is one where sovereign, you know, countries have dominion over currency. So it's an extremely aggressive and dangerous idea to say, I'm going to create a new money. I'm going to become a new monetary authority. So it's amazing that Bitcoin did it, and it's absolutely no surprise to me that virtually everything else has failed.
I don't think there's a better way to finish than that. So I will let you close out by telling people, you know, what you do, where to find you. You know, you referred to your company a couple of times.
Yeah, so I was the co-founder of a blockchain analytics company called Coinmetrics, which is part of the reason I know so much about these various alternative coins, and a partner at a Boston-based venture firm called Castle Island Ventures. We invest in companies building on top of public blockchains like Bitcoin, not the coins. We don't invest in the coins. I just happen to have an infatuation with the history of these coins, especially the history of failure, because I think there's so much we can learn from it. And you can find me on Twitter, Nick_Carter. That's 2 underscores.
Amazing. Nick, you absolutely smashed it. Really appreciate you doing this.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. You know, like, I was starting to get worried that this useless knowledge I'd accumulated over the years would never amount to anything. But, you know, you finally gave me the opportunity to share it with people.
Well, it'll be out to the world next week. So, yeah, thanks a lot, Nick.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. What did you think of that one? Did you enjoy that? For me, this is another really important topic for beginners. I have seen so many people caught up in the hype of altcoins only to lose money. I was in there myself when I was very early into all this stuff. I was seduced by the world of altcoins. I was trading them, thinking I was a genius, making money, and then suddenly losing money. So I think it's really easy to fall for all the altcoin marketing, whether it's directly from the projects or because of some cult group on Twitter which builds around a coin. You tend to see this around Ripple or Nano or BSV or some other bullshit. But the trend is your friend here. Bitcoin has an 11-year trend of survival and value accrual, whereas all the other altcoins are really trending towards zero. So it is a history of failure, and there is a reason why. And you know, you should really try and look at this as objectively as you can. As I said, for a while, I had an interest in alts, and I traded alts. And when I started going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, after losing a bunch of money on alts and you know, trying to be as objective as I can, I started to realize why Bitcoin is the only project worth concentrating on. And so to cover in detail the reasons that alts are a bad investment, I think it's really crucial to have this as part of the beginner's guide. Anyway, I hope you found it useful. As ever, if you've got any feedback, you can reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Oh yeah, and I also need to thank everyone who helps us support the show, everyone who's sharing this beginner's guide out on Twitter, thank you so much, anyone who writes to me, anyone who comes on the show, anyone who sponsors, I love you all. If you do want to help, it's all up on my website. Just go to whatbitcoindid.com, click on the support section, everything you can do to help is listed there. Anyway, hope you enjoyed the show. As I said, if you want to reach out to me, my email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com.